This is Brian Bunk of the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project, and today is April 13th, 2000, and I'm in the ground floor offices at Bascom Hall of Jan Shepherd, and today we're going to be interviewing her about her involvement in gay and lesbian issues on campus. And just a moment ago we were talking about the terminology used, and now it's LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, but it was not always that way.
That's right. As the movement nationally has changed to be more inclusive and include other issues around sexual orientation, that same change has occurred on our campus over the years. That initially, the campus, when it was aware at all, was aware only of gay men and lesbian women. Then I would say in the late 80s, the campus added bisexual to the letters, so we had the GLB community, mm-hmm. the gay, lesbian, bisexual community, and then in the beginning in the early 1990s, but really not ending until, well, not ending, but not being completed, I'd say, until within the last year, we've added the transgender to the list of letters so that mm-hmm. we have lesbian, gay, bi, and transgender now. So usually now when this community is referred to on campus, it says the LGBT community. But as I said, that was recent, and mm-hmm. I believe it was just last year that our Faculty Senate Committee added the transgender to their name.
Okay.
So all of these things are evolutionary.
Are evolving as we speak. When we talked before, you had mentioned that there was another letter that was possibly coming on the horizon.
Well, there are Qs. Some campuses use what's called a Q for questioning. Mm-hmm. And then as the transgender community becomes more vocal and aware of the kinds of differences within their own community, there are individuals who identify not as transgender but as members of both genders. And then there are individuals who identify as members of neither gender. Mm-hmm. And I believe they go by A for androgynous, and I'm not remembering right now what the individuals who identify with both genders go by. Mm-hmm. So it's getting more complex.
Well, for the sake of this interview, I think we will just stick with LGBT.
Sure.
But meaning that to be as inclusive as possible.
Right. I think it's, you know, as really as a culture, the United States starts to recognize the diversity of ways in which people identify their sexual orientation and also their gender identification. Mm-hmm. It's becoming more complex. People are recognizing it's not as simple as being a male and a female and being attracted to the opposite sex or the same sex.
Right, and these are issues that are developing in society as a whole, and that of course the universities all over the country as well as here have to attempt to deal with that.
Trying to recognize those changes.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Okay, well, just to back up a bit, why don't we start, I guess, with a little bit of your background here at the UW. You came here for graduate school to begin with, correct?
I came in graduate school in 1974, August of 1974. Mm-hmm. Began my master's program and stayed here to get my master's and my doctorate in cultural anthropology. Mm-hmm. My major advisor was Kitty McClellan. My focus area was northern North America. I worked with Athabascan Indians and far north British Columbia. Mm-hmm. My minor advisor, who I worked with as much as I did with Kitty, with both of them, they were both wonderful advisors, was Harold Shoib from African Languages and Literatures. His focus is on narrative, and mm-hmm. I was interested in narrative in northern North America.
And how come you chose to attend the UW? You did your undergraduate work at George Washington, correct?
Right, in Washington, D.C. I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Illinois. Mm-hmm. And my family, my parents, were both still in Illinois. My partner I met in the East Coast, he's an Easterner, but convinced that we come back here. And I wanted to be in the Midwest near my family again, and also because of Kitty McClellan and the very strong Northern North America department mm-hmm. that the anthropology program had.
So you came here with an idea that that's what you wanted to study, and
definitely.
Then you carried that out.
Yeah. No, I came as a Northern. I've always been interested in the North.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you got your PhD in anthropology.
That's right.
And then what was your hope then in terms of a career?
Yeah.
Did you think you would end up
no.
in the dean's office?
No, I didn't at all. But it's been a wonderful place to end up. It's totally perfect for who I am and what I wanted to do, but it's not what I expected. When I got my doctorate in 1983, I was 7 months pregnant, and my son was born then 2 months later. And I decided that I was in a position where I could, my husband supported it, stay home with him. So I was home with him for 3.5 years, him, my son.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point started to think about what I was going to do then. That's not the only point I started to think about.
Right.
I hadn't thought about it before then. Started to figure out then what would I be doing. My husband is self-employed. His business is really dependent upon referrals and his links in the community. He had established some pretty strong links in the community. Did not feel we were in a position to be moving around the country,
mm-hmm.
chasing tenure track positions.
Right.
So I had to decide what else might I do. And during the 3.5 years I was at home, I also did some informational interviewing on the campus, because I was thinking about, was I going to go the traditional academic route, where there's some other things I might like to do. During that time, I had an informational interview with Mary Rouse, who was an assistant dean,
mm-hmm.
was not dean of the campus at that point. And what the kinds of things she explained to me that the dean of students office did, and the people in the dean of students office, seemed like a very good match. That Mary herself is a background in classics, and the person Paul Ginsberg, who was dean, had a background in history and social work, and another of the deans was a nurse social worker, and another of the deans had a background in African studies and
mm-hmm.
history. And that was the kind of a academically broad community
right.
that I was very interested in joining.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus, that the kinds of issues that the dean of students office dealt with were the issues that I was interested in anthropology. And I decided that maybe I could reach the students I was interested in, be talking about the kinds of issues that interested me, better in this office than I could in an academic program.
Hmm.
That there was a clear focus on diversity and cultural differences, and how do we serve all of the students that attend such a large campus, whether they are returning adult students or veterans
mm-hmm.
or students of color or international students, that we had to somehow be figuring how to reach people with coming to us really with different expectations and understandings of what they wanted, and how would we reach them. And it seemed to me that my background in anthropology could
mm-hmm.
think about those kinds of issues and help the university make sure that they were including an awareness of cultural differences when we're trying to help students.
Mm-hmm. So you saw this opportunity. It wasn't a question that you didn't enjoy sort of an academic life.
No.
I noticed that you had won a graduate teaching award.
Yeah.
So you must have been an effective teacher.
I did. I loved teaching. And one of the other things that made me think, well, maybe the dean of students office is a good match, is I loved teaching. I taught introductory courses as a teaching assistant.
Mm-hmm.
That's generally what you do. And I really loved the introductory students. They were so open and interested, and
mm-hmm.
you could reach them really easily. But I did. I loved teaching. It was a hard decision to think about maybe not going that route.
Mm-hmm.
But what I loved the immediacy of teaching. And a researcher's life is not very immediate.
Right.
A researcher's life is writing grants 3 years ahead and reviewing research from 2 years ago. And I did the sense of living in the now that you can get when you're working with students in a dean of students office was something that appealed to
mm-hmm.
me.
So it was really fortuitous that the dean of students office in particular you had this kind of connection with. Because it sounds as though you didn't have a career in administration in mind,
no.
but rather you wanted to deal with students, and if teaching wasn't an opportunity, then this was sort of a similar way of dealing with students.
Well, I think this, yeah, I think the dean of students office provided me a lot of things that that teaching didn't. It provided me stability, whereas teaching would require that I be moving, and
right.
I didn't want to be moving my family. It also, I think, did give me this opportunity to respond to students on a more immediate level.
Mm-hmm.
The time frame in research While I loved research, and it is one of the things I miss here, I adored the time I spent writing my dissertation, and I spent it in one of the cages in the library.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I loved my little Carol. I had pictures up, and it was a safe haven. I really enjoyed working there. So I like the privacy of research, but I also know that I almost like it too much, that it's a way that I can become very isolated, and that worried me. I didn't want to become isolated in that way. Also, I think that research is a very individual endeavor, and I think I'm happier, whereas I like that, I think I'm actually happier and more effective when I'm working in more cooperative endeavors. Mm-hmm. And again, this office, what we do in this office, we do sort of as a team. You fail or succeed based upon everybody's efforts, and everybody gets the benefit and everybody pays the price. Whereas it felt to me that, and maybe this is inaccurate, but it felt to me that research was more your own success or your own failure.
Right. Well, your field, I would think, would be particularly appropriate for that, because I don't know much about anthropology as a field, but it seems to involve more kind of interaction and contact with people than,
exactly,
say, as a historian. I know that I could do my research and not ever talk to anyone or deal with anyone except for people in the past who probably are already dead.
That's right.
Whereas as an anthropologist, at least to my knowledge of the field, involves a much more interactive approach to even to research.
Well, absolutely. It's interesting you say that, because my dissertation had both of those. Mm-hmm. Kitty McClellan comes out of a natural science tradition, which was very strong in the early years of anthropology, and is very historically focused. And so my dissertation was actually two sections. It was almost like two dissertations. The first part, completely historical, trying to determine who were these people and how did they get where they were, like the community where I was working. And for that, I worked totally in archives. And so it was a historical analysis without people, whereas the second part was based upon the field work I did, which was the result of interactions, being in the community. Who were the people? What were they valuing? What did they care about? How did they accept me or not accept me? How did they respond to the changes in Canada? So probably those two components of my field work sort of echo, or my dissertation echo, the two components of my life in terms of, well, was I going to go the more strictly academic, and in this case also archival way, or was I going to go the way that focused more on the interaction?
Oh, right, I see. So your background then led you to this kind of position. How did you become involved in LGBT issues? Was that something that you were involved with throughout your graduate career, or was it only after you were employed in the dean's office?
Okay. I came to the dean's office when Mary Rouse had very recently been appointed dean. So I started in December, and Mary had been appointed dean in September.
Of 1987,
is this? I'm worried about this. You probably checked that out.
I can look. It's on the CV, which is in your folder in the oral history project for anyone, any future researchers listening.
I think it may be 86, actually.
Okay.
I think it's December of 86.
You were part-time at first.
I was part-time, right, and then I became full-time in June of 87.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, and Mary came in September, and Chancellor Shalala came in also right around that time, just before Mary did.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of exciting changes going on. When I joined the staff, Mary had recently become dean, and she and Paul Ginsberg, during her 17 years on staff before becoming dean, had a committee that worked with students looking at talking about sexual orientation issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that committee had become relatively inactive during the mid-80s, 1980s. So when Mary became dean, she decided that she wanted to make sure that there wasn't an ongoing need for that committee, and that she shouldn't some way revise those issues, or readdress, those issues. So she began talking with Kevin McIntyre, who was a member of her staff and had expressed an interest in gay and lesbian issues to her. And she also talked with me and said, would I have an interest? I said, yes, I would very much have an interest in helping in any way I could. So Kevin McIntyre and I, at Mary's request, really drafted a proposal to start a committee, mm-hmm. to start a new committee that could look at lesbian and gay issues on the campus. And Mary was very receptive, liked our proposal, said, yes, great, let's do this. Mm-hmm. And that's when we began the committee that was called the GLIC Committee, the mm-hmm. Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee.
And this was this when you first started, or
when
was
this
later?
When I first started, I think it was one of the very first things that I did mm-hmm. when I was on staff.
So it was 86, 87, yes. right around in there.
Right.
Now this was before the ROTC controversy, I guess, came about, or there was the was this sort of going on at the same time?
It was definitely going on at the same time because the election was taking place. Mm-hmm. And there had been a lot of talk about addressing the national discrimination that occurred in mm-hmm. the country against gays and lesbians on the basis of sexual orientation. And of course it was after Wisconsin had become the first nation, the first state in the nation to pass a non-discrimination mm-hmm. law that prohibited discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in housing and accommodation. Mm-hmm. Or housing and employment, I'm sorry. So, I mean, these issues were not new in Wisconsin and certainly not new in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you know why they happened to be kind of bubbling up or appearing at that time? It seems as though there are several different strands that are coming together around that period in 86, 87, 88, and from many different points of view. Do you have any guess as to how come that suddenly became a big issue at that particular moment?
Boy, I should. What else was happening right then?
I imagine that's about the time when AIDS became more became established more in the sort of mainstream media. That may be part of it.
That could have been it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It certainly was present. I mean, I think it has been an ongoing controversy about the kind of discrimination that the Department of Defense has, and I think it definitely was based on student interest. Mm-hmm. The students were extremely concerned. We had a couple of students. Tracy Prouty was a student, and Dave Wilcox was a student. There were a number of students who were very concerned about the fact that that gay students were not allowed to enter our ROTC programs, mm-hmm. and that ROTC did offer students a wonderful scholarship opportunity. And that opportunity was denied to students who were gays or lesbians mm-hmm. because they couldn't enter. They could enter the program, but they couldn't be commissioned officers.
Right.
So if they entered the program, it didn't provide them any advantage because mm-hmm. they would go through this program and couldn't get the results. That mm-hmm. would be like going through entering the university and not being able to get a degree. So that was one of the issues that often came out, is that ROTC would say, well, we don't deny you access to the program, which is true, but they could not be commissioned as officers after going mm-hmm. through the program.
So the question was an issue of discrimination or a lack of access, equal access to scholarship opportunities based only on sexual orientation.
That's right. This is a Department of Defense, or what at that point was a Department of Defense policy. It wasn't our local ROTC programs.
Mm-hmm.
It was from the Department of Defense.
Right,
it was a federal policy.
Mm-hmm. So then there was a resolution that was drafted and signed.
Well, and the chancellor actually as well, Chancellor Shalala, was actively trying to address these issues and trying to get some changes, and had worked with the national education associations to have all of those national education associations also actively worked to lobby the Department of Defense to get this changed. And a number of those, perhaps all, I'm afraid, I can't remember right now how many, there were four, I believe, National Education Associations involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it may have been that each of them independently drafted their own resolution that they sent to the Department of Defense saying, we feel this is a discriminatory policy that does not allow equal access for our students.
Right.
So there were national efforts going on, and Chancellor Shalala was very active in those national efforts through her involvement in national education associations.
Mm-hmm.
So what was happening on our campus was just a local level effort that was happening across the nation.
Right.
On other campuses and at a national level on education associations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was really, a lot of the leadership came from the chancellor,
mm-hmm.
to start to address these issues and the students. I think there was leadership on a lot of levels. There was leadership in the faculty from Joe Elder and Jim Stakely in the faculty senate. There was leadership in the academic staff assembly by a number of people, and then leadership on the student level.
Mm-hmm.
And the chancellor also spoke with our Board of Regents, and our Board of Regents passed a resolution saying this was a matter of concern to them, and that they requested that each of the campuses, and our chancellor particularly, not ignore this issue, continue to work on this issue on a national level, that this was an issue that needed to be changed on a national level because mm-hmm. it was a federal policy.
Right. It couldn't necessarily be changed just on individual campuses. It had to be changed from the top.
Right. But mm-hmm. that the Board of Regents supported these sorts of changes.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was after this whole ROTC resolution that you talked about. What happened was that the Faculty Senate passed a resolution stating that they felt the ROTC policies on the campus currently were discriminatory,
mm-hmm.
and that to be consistent with university policy on non-discrimination that did include sexual orientation as one of our grounds for non-discrimination, that the campus needed to be changing this.
Mm-hmm.
This Faculty Senate said they saw an inconsistency between our university non-discrimination policy that disallowed discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation,
mm-hmm.
and the policy of some of our programs within ROTC that needed to be following Department of Defense
mm-hmm.
policy, which instituted discrimination on sexual orientation.
It seems as though there would be a conflict not only with the university policy, but also with the state policy now.
Exactly.
So it was on many different levels, I suppose.
That's right.
Now, so this was about the same time that you were beginning to the draft or the formation of the committee. So did you work?
Yes, the committee was right before this. The committee began soon before all of this. And so, yes, the committee was also very aware of what was happening and involved, all
mm-hmm.
the members of the committee.
And what was your particular role on the committee? Were you?
I guess I'm not sure I remember exactly at the beginning whether I was an appointee to the committee or I was a staff person. I may have been a staff person.
Mm-hmm. And this is the Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee.
Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee, GLIC.
Okay.
What I see here you have is it began in 1998 or 89. So perhaps it did begin just immediately after the resolution, but it was in the works long before that.
Mm-hmm. Before when we talked, you had mentioned about you had had some contact or role in the conversations or interactions between some of the student leaders of the LGB community and the ROTC students.
Right.
Perhaps you could describe how
that was really a very amazing period, and it really gave some real student leaders an opportunity to shine, I think. When the ROTC issue was a hot issue on campus, and students were in fact sitting in Bascom Hall around this issue, there was a coalition of students, the Minority Coalition was addressing issues of race on the campus at this time, which were also extremely controversial, hot, you might say, causing a lot of protest. The Minority Coalition was an active coalition, and they decided to band with the LGBT students on the campus and provide their support to this ROTC issue, the issue of students not being allowed into ROTC based upon sexual orientation. So there was a lot of activity on the campus around these issues. They were being discussed. There were students sleeping in Bascom Hall. It was very much what was in the news, much as now the issue is sweatshops on our campus. But at that point, in the 88, 89 years, the issue in 87 as well, the issue was ROTC and discrimination on that basis. And what came to the attention in our office, in the Dean of Students' office, was that students who were in the ROTC program and at times needed to be in uniform were experiencing harassment when they were in uniform, and that they were feeling uncomfortable being on the campus in uniform because students were making assumptions about how they felt on the issue of discrimination against gays and lesbians.
So it was an issue that went beyond just the LGBT community and was more of a campus-wide...
It was definitely a campus-wide issue. Mm-hmm. It was the issue that was being discussed in the student newspapers on a day-in and day-out basis. And we, of course, knew that just because somebody was wearing a uniform didn't mean that they were hostile towards gays and lesbians, that they were in support of the Department of Defense policy any more than we as a university were in support of the Department of Defense policy. This was just a policy that was existing. And so we certainly did not want students that were in ROTC and had a whole range of ideas and opinions on sexual orientation to be unfairly harassed. And we were quite certain that the leaders in the lesbian gay community felt the same way. If we could only reach them and make sure that they understood what was happening, that there was no way they were going to be supporting the harassment of students in uniform solely because they were wearing a uniform. Or for any other reason, that they weren't going to be supporting harassment. So we decided that what we really needed to do was to make sure that the leaders in the ROTC program, that the student leaders in that program, the young men and women who were the, I'm sorry, I don't know the correct terms, the students at the highest level of the student of the hierarchy that reported to their captains, who were staff people, and the students who were leading the ROTC, the efforts to change the ROTC policy, had a chance to meet one another and understand they were both students trying to get an education and trying to pursue what was of interest to them. So we contacted the various captains in the ROTC programs and asked if we could connect with their student leaders in those programs in order that those students and the LGBT student leaders could maybe come meet together and in some way communicate to the campus that neither of them wanted harassment towards the other. That the ROTC students did not want any discriminatory actions or harassment towards gay and lesbian students, and that the gay and lesbian students did not want harassment or name-calling towards the ROTC students. And fortunately, everybody involved was very cooperative, and we were able to bring together all of those student leaders, and together they signed a resolution stating that, stating that these efforts to end discrimination were meant to support all students, and that uninformed, uneducated, hate-filled harassment towards either group was not what they supported. And it really required a lot of collaboration on both parts, that the student leaders in ROTC were very courageous, I think, in being willing to take these steps, because they do they did report to the Department of Defense. And they needed to be certain that they weren't being contradictory to their orders. And fortunately, their direct supervisors, their captains, their staff people here on campus, gave them an okay to be involved in this effort and said it was not, it was not against orders, that they weren't saying anything against the Department of Defense by signing a statement that urged students to not harass other students.
So it wasn't that the resolution that they signed disagreed with the Department of Defense policy in any way. It was just an agreement to be civil to one another.
That's right. It was separate from the Department of Defense policy. Mm-hmm. But it was still, because the Department of Defense policy was what the larger issue was about, it still took a lot of courage for them to...
We were talking about the interaction between the LGBT student leaders and the ROTC student leaders.
Right. And the ROTC student leaders were a part of the military administration. They were part of the military hierarchy. And so they had to be very clear that they did not be disobeying orders. This was their education. I mean, they had a lot at risk. They couldn't jeopardize their position within the ROTC program as the student commanders or the mm-hmm. student leaders. This was really an honor they had achieved. They didn't want to jeopardize that honor, and we wanted to make sure they didn't as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine too that there was risk not only for the ROTC students. Leaders but for the other students
exactly.
as well, because you don't want to be seen to be cavorting with the enemy, so to speak.
That's right,
put it
absolutely.
In military terms.
And I think they, you know, they had been on the receiving end of discrimination. And so for them to be willing to take the risk and meet students who were in a system that actively discriminated against them was also, I think, mm-hmm. very kind and open and willing to learn on the part of the gay and lesbian students. And I think that I hope it was a positive experience for both of them to mm-hmm. see that really none of the students involved had any interest in expressing hateful opinions towards other students.
Right.
And that they recognized they all were students and they all were trying to get through. That they perhaps did have different opinions on the Department of Defense policy, but that that was a different issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall any specific individuals that were involved on either side?
Or? Yeah, Tracy Prouty was, I believe it was Dave Wilcox and Tracy Prouty from the 10% Society on the gay and lesbian side. And I unfortunately, there were four students from ROTC mm-hmm. because there was Navy, Army, Marines, and Air Force mm-hmm. all involved.
Well, I think there's a copy of that resolution. I can probably get it and put it in the file with those names of those people. Who,
that would be great.
So that they could be at least recognized
That's
for
right.
their accomplishments.
That would be wonderful. Dave Wilcox was on campus for a number of years after that and is still in the Madison area as far as I know right now. And Tracy Prouty actually went to our vet school mm-hmm. after her involvement in 10%. I believe graduated as a veterinarian.
Oh, okay. So this is all going on, and then the Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee now is formed. You said the process had been sort of going in motion for quite a while. Was there any sort of pressure from any other groups, from student groups or faculty groups, to maybe make this a kind of visible presence?
Sure, I think that this was seen as a way in which issues such as the ROTC issue would have a more institutionalized avenue to be talking about what's happening to gay and lesbian students on the campus.
Mm-hmm. And when there's an official committee, I suppose it means that it's a serious topic or something. It kind of
yes.
gives it a
right.
stamp of approval, maybe.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say, what were the goals or the ideas behind the committee when it was formed? I mean, what was the purpose?
I think the purpose was to help the campus address in an organized, coherent fashion the kinds of stresses and pressures that gay and lesbian students had. Because we knew that although our campus had non-discrimination sexual orientation issues, and our state was the first state to mm-hmm. have them, we knew that at that point there were very, very few other states or campuses that had those kinds of situations, and that our students were coming from high schools where probably the words gay and lesbian had never been mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's been an enormous change in the last 10 years, or 12 years now, but at that point it was extremely unusual that gay and lesbian students were out in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So they were coming to our campus closeted, and we needed to figure out how were we going to reach them, how were we going to be assisting them, how were we going to be assisting faculty and staff who wanted to be outreaching to gay and lesbian students.
Was there an impression that maybe this was another case? Oftentimes in Wisconsin, there's this idea that Madison is this strange place that does all these kind of loony things. And do you think that there was some impression that this was another case where here's liberal Madison again doing all these what might be perceived as strange and kind of crazy things?
Well, I think as the state capital and a relatively larger city in a rural state, Madison had for a long time had within the gay and lesbian community was felt to have a larger gay and lesbian community. It was considered a place where gays and lesbians could come to meet other gays and lesbians, whereas rural communities certainly were not that way.
Right.
So I think there was a tradition, if you will, in that Madison was at least a place where these issues could be talked about, that there were gay bars here and that there were long-time gay communities. And I think the fact of our being the first gay rights state is hugely important. I mean, it made a big difference. So we have always been considered to have a larger gay and lesbian population. Now, it is still the case that the gays and lesbians are largely, even if not closeted, they are not always necessarily very public in being a gay or lesbian person. So I'm not sure we'll ever know whether that's really true or just in other cities it's not as visible. But I think Madison has had a more visible presence of gays and lesbians for many years that most cities did not have.
Okay, so I knew that Madison had in recent years anyway, Madison has had a reputation as a city, a nationwide reputation as a city that is very friendly. And so that reputation is not just a product of the last 5 years, but it's
absolutely
gone back 10 or 15 or more years.
Oh, no, since the early 1900s, I would say.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Okay, maybe you could talk a little bit about sort of the functioning of the committee. I guess I'm not that familiar with how these things work. I mean, did the committee meet once a month or once every 6 months, or how did that, kind of nuts and bolts?
Sure.
Because
it was a committee appointed by the Dean of Students Office, it was a committee to address student issues. So that was the charge of the committee, was to address the needs of students. How were they being met? How should they be met?
And the committee was made up of faculty, staff, and students?
That's right. The committee was made up of faculty, staff, and students. We had equal faculty, staff, and students. I believe it was about four of each. I would have to check that. I think that's right. It could have even been five of each. It may have been a 15-person committee. It was somewhere between 12 and 15. And it may have even been that it changed somewhat from year to year. I'm sure it was at least a 12-person committee. That's seeming more correct, that there were four faculty, four students, and four staff. And then in addition, I think I was an additional person. So in fact, there were five staff. And we very strongly wanted the faculty involvement, that we felt that was really key to get faculty on the campus aware of and working with the Dean of Students Office to be helping students who were gay and lesbian. And the faculty leaders, we usually had a co-chair situation of a faculty person and a staff person. So usually the faculty member was the chair and then a staff person was the co-chair. We met monthly. I think we even perhaps met bi-weekly for periods of time when the report was in process. We tried to have good representation from the student committee, the student community. I'd say our meetings were very well attended. We sometimes it's hard to get students to attend committee meetings because they're so overcommitted, but I'd say we had excellent attendance on the GLIT committee.
Just on the interview outline here, I wrote down some of the people that appeared on the committee. I wondered if you wanted to talk at all about some of these individuals and maybe what their role was
right.
on the committee.
I'd say Jim Stakely and Claudia Card, I believe, were initial members of the committee, and Jim Stakely was a strong committee member throughout its years,
mm-hmm.
Until it was replaced by the Faculty Senate Committee, and then Jim was actually the first chair of that committee as well. Jim was also, he's a committee member in, a faculty member in the German department,
mm-hmm.
and Jim believes, and I have no reason to doubt him, that he was the first out faculty person ever hired on our campus.
Oh.
That he was hired by the German department as an out gay man.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really quite a milestone.
And that was in the mid-70s, I think?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think he came on campus in, I want to say 75 or 70. It was in the early mid-70s,
right.
I
didn't realize it was even that early.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. And Jim had been a very active support of our 10% Society, which is one of the student groups on campus, and had been an advisor for 10% for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
including these years.
Oh, okay. And 10% started in 82 or something like
that? No, 10% started back in the 70s as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 10% had started long, long ago.
Hmm.
It was a very old student group. So Jim, Claudia Card from the Department of Philosophy and Women's Studies was very active. Mary Amney Watley from the Department of Women's Studies and Curriculum and Instruction. I believe that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Meg Gaines from the law school was very involved in the committee.
It sounds like some of the faculty were on the committee for several years. Was that the case with the students, or was there more turnover in the student representation?
No, when students could, we urged them to stay on the committee for several years. Carmen Ballantyne, who was listed here, and Sarah Waddell, where I know were on for at least 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
We did try to keep students. As long as a student wasn't graduating, we tried to continue them and just add new students.
Right.
So.
I'm kind of curious, like I said, I have no experience with the kind of university administration and the committee. I wonder how the kind of dynamics work in those situations when you have faculty, staff, and students, and especially in a committee like this, where at this time it seemed a very vocal, very political kind of topic, and I wondered if maybe you could just comment on how sorts of interactions went.
Yeah. My memory of this committee, and I don't think it's Pollyanna, my memory was that this was actually a very unified committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because all of the members of the committee had very personal and strong connections to gay and lesbian issues, and so I think they felt very unified in trying
mm-hmm.
to help the campus move forward on something that had been hidden and ignored for a lot of years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the sense of everybody working together to make a pretty important change, that this was the only way those changes were going to happen, it was if people like themselves stepped forward and worked on those
right.
changes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was a real sense of camaraderie in the committee. I don't remember any senses of role differentiation based upon status.
Right. Oh, okay.
So it was actually a very unified committee, and I think it was an opportunity at that point, again, because these issues were still pretty new on the campus and
mm-hmm.
were pretty hidden, for students to have contact with individuals who either identified as gay and lesbian themselves or were committed to working on gay and lesbian issues. There was no other avenue for students to see adults, in parentheses, end quotes, who were out about these
mm-hmm.
issues. So I think it was extremely empowering for the students. Now it's a little different. Student, you know, gay and lesbian issues are on the news and in the soap operas and on television and
mm-hmm.
all over. So I think there isn't as much a sense of no adults in this community being connected to these issues
right.
that as there was at those days.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's necessarily any easier for gay and lesbian students to connect with people who are understanding about gay and lesbian issues.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not the silence in the community at large that there
mm-hmm.
was then.
Well, it's just not as uncommon, I would think, to be kind of publicly or more obviously out in the community as it might have been
then.
At this time.
That's
yeah.
right. I think it still can be very hard for students to connect mm-hmm. with gay and lesbian community members on campus.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially depending, I suppose, on the background. If you come from a small rural community and then you come here, it can be intimidating just in that factor. And then if you have this other issue to deal with as well, I guess, it can be even more intimidating, I suppose, and difficult mm-hmm. to reach out under any circumstances.
That's right, exactly. And I think, you know, faculty and staff are just living their own lives, and their day schedule is very different than students' days, so
right.
it can just be hard for those groups to intersect,
mm-hmm.
and that's still the case.
Right.
But I think back in the late 80s, not only was it hard for the groups to intersect, I think students didn't even know where to begin to ask those sorts of questions, because there wasn't the committee, there wasn't a full-time liaison, there wasn't a student center like there is now.
Mm-hmm.
So the opportunity for gay and lesbian students to come forward, be recognized as gay and lesbian students, and to be working on these issues with faculty and staff, I think was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the committee was working on a report for the Dean of Students.
That's right. The charge of the committee was to produce a report on what were the issues that gay and lesbian students faced,
mm-hmm.
and how should the university respond to these needs.
And how did the committee go about deciding on those issues? Was it simply based on the committee members' experiences, or was there a kind of research that was conducted?
No, there was very extensive research, and as you see, the committee was, the charge for the committee was 1989, the report didn't actually get published until 92, and that,
mm-hmm.
and during that time, it wasn't that the committee didn't get down to the work. The committee was doing extensive work. They interviewed widely across campus. They interviewed students and faculty and academic staff. They talked about spiritual issues and academic issues and social issues. And once they had all that research, then they drafted extensively and over, and they sent out drafts to other constituencies to get feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very long and careful process to try to put together a strong report.
Did the committee take any influences from any outside? I think that there were this kind of process was going on at other universities,
yes.
too, around the same time.
Yes.
Was there a good deal of connection between universities or these sorts of committees at various locations, or was it really kind of an isolated, each one working on it kind of on their own?
No, I think there was. I mean, it was hard to make connections, just like it's hard on any issue to make
right.
connections. It's just a lot to do. But the committee definitely tried to make those connections. We invited people from Minnesota to come and speak with us. We invited people from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to come and speak with us because they were working to establish a certificate program in gay studies. The people from Minnesota came specifically to talk with us on domestic partner policy issues. We had, at that point, one of the committee members that we didn't mention was Jane Schachter, who was also in our law school, whose area of expertise is sexual orientation in the law. And she would give presentations on issues.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried very hard to be in contact with other campuses and around the nation and get their reports as they got published. Within the university system, I think that our report was the first, I believe. That may not be the case,
mm-hmm.
but it was certainly among the first, because I remember that after ours was published, we had contact with Whitewater and River Falls and Green Bay as they began to put together task forces
mm-hmm.
to address the same issue. And Brian, you had asked me before about UW system.
Mm-hmm.
And this was actually the point at which we did start an informal UW system network on gay and lesbian issues.
Oh.
And it was just for that reason, in that we wanted to make sure we knew what was happening at other campuses. That we did have a sense that at Madison we had some advantages because of the legislature, because of David Clarenbach, who was our local state representative, who
mm-hmm.
had been very instrumental in the passage of the Gay Rights Act in our state.
Mm-hmm.
So we did feel we had some real advantages in
right.
being in Madison.
And kind of a size, probably,
size
as well.
Size and just the flagship school. I mean, the other campuses looked to us and we wanted to make sure that we were responding to that respect and honor. So we, I sent an invitation out to, I tried to get names from all of the different campuses as best I could, just through networking, saying, do you know somebody at this school?
Right. And this was the days before everyone had an email or a website.
Yes, it was before that.
You could go and search for, to see who's interested in this kind of thing.
That's right.
You had
email
to do the old-fashioned kind of networking.
That's right.
Phone calls and letters,
that's
I suppose.
That's right. But email was just starting. And so it eventually was an email list that I maintained. One time I was very proud. Someone gave me the title of Queen of the Email because I established an email list of people on our campus and then also an email list around the network, around the system. And I would, and people would forward things from around the nation and from the campus to me, and then I would send it out on these email lists. So we tried to get names of contacts, and we tried hard to get both faculty and academic staff contacts around the system, and invited everybody to Madison and had a meeting here in Madison, and I believe we got 60 people to that first meeting, which was really
this?
Very exciting. Oh, I was afraid you're going to ask that.
This was after the report was issued or before, during the drafting process? I guess maybe that's a good way to pin it down.
It was probably, I'm not sure it was after, but it was probably near the completion of the report.
So it was around 1992?
Yeah, it was probably 91. And then eventually the report was released and then people continued to come. Initially we, so it was it really began as a faculty staff effort, that we thought that students were pretty good at networking themselves and that we wanted to be sure we were addressing the needs of people really on the firing line within the institution and helping one another move the institution. And initially we felt maybe by, that maybe we wanted to not include students in these meetings because we needed to be talking very honestly with one another about what were the pressures on our campus.
Right.
And we didn't really feel it was appropriate that students kind of know where the where some of the stumbling blocks were. Because we wanted to be supporting students and saying, giving, that we were afraid that would be discouraging to students.
Right.
And not really information that should be shared. I think, and I can't remember at what point we did this, whether this was actually at the very first meeting, we did invite students, but we invited them so that they could have their own separate meeting, or whether we did that at the second meeting.
Students from around,
around
all the campuses.
Yes, that what we did, and that may have even been the first meeting, that we invited staff, faculty, and students, and asked that all three constituencies be represented. I think we did do that at the very first meeting, but that we actually planned for the students to be meeting separately, that we would have one initial meeting as a whole group, and then we would break out as administrators and students, so that administrators could talk about how do we facilitate change on the campus? Where are where are the obstacles? Are the obstacles ideological? Are they just procedural? Are they just process procedural? And that students had their own issues they needed to be addressing, and we should let students meet separately. So that committee met here at the Memorial Union, that first UW System Network committee, and we decided to meet three times a year.
Now, was it still, it was a,
informal.
It was an informal, organization.
Yes.
At that point.
Informal organization. It's still an informal
organization. Okay. There's no, I don't know anything again about how the UW system works, but there are system-wide committees or organizations.
And actually over the years we've approached system and spoken with them and spoken among ourselves in terms of, well, what are the advantages of becoming recognized and what are the disadvantages? But at this point we've always been informal. We met, we've met I think at least twice over the years with Tessa Rennes, who used to be in the, is now a vice president, but was a special assistant to the president to address minority affairs, but LGBT was not included among the minority affairs. But we felt Tess was probably still our best ally there. And also Evan Norris, who is also in system administration and works with chancellors of the different system schools advising on student affairs concerns.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember specifically one meeting we had at Milwaukee. We also tried to rotate the meetings. So the first one was at UW-Madison, but
mm-hmm.
we tried to rotate it around the system so
Oh, right, yeah.
People didn't always feel they had to come to Madison. Actually, eventually, after moving it around, people said they all liked to come to Madison, and we ended up sending it back to Madison. But we did go to Green Bay, we went to Oshkosh, we went to River Falls, I believe, we went to Whitewater, and we went to Milwaukee, for sure, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the Milwaukee meeting, both Evan Norris and Tessa Rennes came to speak to us. And at that point, they advised that we remain informal. That they said that we had their support and that they were there as allies for us to advise us, but that based on the regents and the legislature at the time, that they felt politically we were in a better position to remain informal than to draw the attention of more conservative members of the board and of the legislature, who may not want the university moving in these directions.
Mm-hmm. So there was a feeling that if this was formalized as an official committee, I don't know what the word is, committee or network, then that would have repercussions in
that
with the legislature?
That it could, and with the board.
Hmm.
This was in 90, probably 93 or 94, when we got that advice.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe 94 and 95, UW-Milwaukee was in the process of establishing a UW a certificate program on gay and lesbian studies. And they were virtually complete with that process when there was some resistance raised among legislators that then contacted the Board of Regents and said, what are we doing? Why are we studying gays and lesbians? This is terrible. We shouldn't be doing this, and this is not a valid area of academic pursuit. That's what some of the legislatures were saying, legislators were saying. What happened was that the Board of Regents did investigate, did open this as an area of discussion. And I believe, fortunately, what they discovered is that Milwaukee had gone through all of the absolutely appropriate processes on their campus, had followed all of the correct permissions, received all of those permissions, and because it was a certificate program, there was no way in which the board was involved in that process.
Oh, okay.
And that they said they had no say over it, and the certificate program should stand.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very worrisome for a period, because the legislators were trying to pressure the board to basically override what had happened at the Milwaukee campus.
Well, that seems as though that's a dangerous topic to get involved with if you're the Board of Regents, or the legislature for that matter, because essentially it's an issue of telling the university campuses what they can or cannot teach, I suppose, ultimately.
Well, but I think that it was really because it was a certificate program. I wish my memory was more exact here. But had it been some other kind of program, I believe that there is a step where the Board of Regents needs to approve new departments or new something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only because of the kind of program that it actually was that did not require a board approval that the board was able to kind of just sidestep the whole issue.
Mm-hmm.
The legislators were saying the board needed to be involved in the process. And had it been some other kind, I believe had it been a full-fledged department, the board would have at some point had a sign-off on it.
And then what do you think would have been the...
Well, at that point, it would not have passed.
Was there...
Given the makeup of the board at the time.
Was there a feeling among the people who were involved in the network that remaining an unofficial entity was a good thing, or were there people who thought maybe that they, in other words, to kind of challenge or force the hand of the legislature and to say, to refuse to be sort of, not silenced is probably not a good word, but Do you see what I mean here?
Yes.
If
no,
there was a
I'd
question.
There was a question. I remember we had one whole meeting devoted to this. At least one whole meeting where we had at least 40 people in the circle and we were all talking about. I think that the group was split, that we saw the advantages, that there were advantages and disadvantages to each.
Mm-hmm.
One of the disadvantages to becoming formally recognized was that many of the people in the circle probably would not become the people who were members of the committee. That people who were in this circle were people who had self-identified as interested in these issues. And they were not necessarily in a dean of students' office. They might have been in housing, or they might have been in a counseling center, or they might have been in an academic department.
Mm-hmm.
But they were interested in moving these issues forward on their campus. They had been perhaps an advisor to a student group.